good evening, good morning. For us, it's the 24th of January, but in India, it's the morning of the 25th. The music that we just heard was from the 25th of January, 1963. Sweet music nonetheless, but maybe that notation sweetens it still more. So we're still working in Chapter 2, in Book 2, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. We're drawing towards the close of the chapter now. Sri Aurobindo has, in the last paragraph, noted parenthetically that Satchit Ananda, this all-encompassing, all-expressive, all-retiring reality, is Satchit Ananda as a person, a personal being. It is not simply blank existence, homogenized being. It is the power of the person, which expresses itself as this universe beyond ordination and within every ordination. So we continue now. If we admit the divine being, the supreme person and all person as the Ishvara, a difficulty arises in understanding his rule or government of world existence, because we immediately transfer to him our mental conception of a human ruler. We picture him as acting by the mind and mental will in an omnipotent, arbitrary fashion upon a world on which he imposes his mental conceptions as laws, and we conceive of his will as a free caprice of his personality. So this is anthropomorphism that we project upon the divine being. Ishvara is the word that means master of existence, the all-ruler. And of course, the nearest equivalent to us is that of emperor or king, something where one is above all others, all are his subjects, and he exerts and exacts his will without let or hindrance. This is typical of the hierarchical division, minus the oneness, so typical of the human mind. But this is not the correct picture of what is the Ishvara, or who is the Ishvara. He continues, but there is no need for the divine being to act by an arbitrary will or idea as an omnipotent yet ignorant human being, if such an omnipotence were possible, might do. For he is not limited by mind. He has an all-consciousness in which he is aware of the truth of all things and aware of his own all-wisdom, working them out according to the truth that is in them, their significance, their possibility or necessity, the imperative selfness of their nature. This harkens back to the citations that we saw at the beginning of the chapter, drawn from the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. Sri Aurobindo here is using the masculine pronoun he, by the way, in accordance with the conventions of his time. The divine, he writes, is free and not bound by laws of any making. But still he acts by laws and processes because they are the expression of the truth of things, not their mechanical, mathematical, or other outward truth alone, but the spiritual reality of what they are, what they have become and have yet to become, what they have it within themselves to realize. So cosmic expression, external forces and events, must have an inner character and index. We see here, too, that whether we're talking about the mechanical forces of the universe, gravity, etc., or whether we're talking about mathematics, all these express outwardly, the mystery of oneness. He is himself present in the working, but he also exceeds and can overrule it. For on one side, nature works according to her limited complex of formulas and is informed and supported in their execution by the divine presence. But on the other side, there is an overseeing, a higher working and determination, even an intervention, free but not arbitrary, often appearing to us magical and miraculous because it proceeds and acts upon nature from a divine supernature. Nature here is a limited expression of that supernature and open to intervention or mutation by its light, its force, its influence. This goes back to the metaphysic of the Bhagavad Gita, where the Purushottama is equivalent with Paraprakriti, the supreme nature, who is above all and who expresses itself in the lower field of nature, according to the triple gunas that we live with and experience every day, sattva, rajas, and tamas. All the mechanical forces of the universe are expressions ultimately of that highest nature. So this is a kind of skeletal expression of what is the real substance of nature above. And when that higher nature wishes to intervene, to inject itself into the play of phenomena, it can, it will and can suspend the rules of the game and influence. But it doesn't do it in an arbitrary way that is irrational or destructive. It has the larger view, it knows where it's going, and so works meticulously and constantly through all beings according to the truth of who they are and where they are in the scheme of things, where they are in the scheme of their own development, to drive everything towards the conclusion that it wishes. It may not be the mathematically defined result that we aim at, but it is the divine intention that is realized, not the human. The mechanical, mathematical, automatic law of things is a fact. But within it, there is a spiritual law of consciousness at work, which gives to the mechanical steps of nature's forces an inner turn and value, a significant rightness, and a secretly conscious necessity. And above it, there is a spiritual freedom that knows and acts in the supreme and universal truth of the Spirit. Our view of the divine government of the world or of the secret of its action is either incurably anthropomorphic or else incurably mechanical. Both the anthropomorphism and mechanism have their elements of truth, but they are only a side, an aspect. And the real truth is that the world is governed by the one in all and over all who is infinite in his consciousness. And it is according to the law and logic of an infinite consciousness that we ought to understand the significance and building and movement of the universe. Anthropomorphic, in the shape of a man. So there is a ruler, there is a mechanism, but it is not the dominant one crushing the intention of the many. The one exists in the many and are an expression of it. The one is the ruler, it is the all, it is each individual being. So if we don't get to the inner meaning of what this expressive power is, manifest in cosmos in person, we can't understand the significance of nature's laws. We can't really see nature as she is. There's something deeper going on. There's a greater story being told in all of our lives. He continues, if we regard this aspect of the one reality and put it in close connection with the other aspects, we can get a complete view of the relation between the eternal self-existence and the dynamics of the consciousness force by which it manifests the universe. And so, again, we're back to Satchitananda, but here, primarily existence and its expressive power through its own self-knowledge, self-awareness, consciousness force, Chit-Shakti. Sat and Chit-Shakti. If we place ourselves in a silent self-existence, immobile, static, inactive, it will appear that a conceptive consciousness force, Maya, able to effectuate all its conceptions, a dynamic consort of the self of silence, is doing everything. It takes its stand on the fixed, unmoving, eternal status and casts the spiritual substance of being into all manner of forms and movements to which its passivity consents or in which it takes its impartial pleasure, its immobile delight of creative and mobile existence. A consort is a partner, a companion. So again, Satchitananda. Whether this be a real or an illusory existence, that must be its substance and significance. Consciousness is at play with being. Force of nature does what it wills with existence and makes it the stuff of her creations. But secretly, the consent of the being must be there at every step to make this possible. So there is not a subjection of the substance of being. It is a willed consent. It may be invisible to the view of the mind, but it is there. It is implied in its acceptance. There is an evident truth in this perception of things. I think I have missed a sentence. Consciousness is at play with being. Force of nature does what it wills with existence and makes it the stuff of her creations. But secretly, the consent of the being must be there at every step to make this possible. No, I've read the sentence twice. There is an evident truth in this perception of things. It is what we see happening everywhere in us and around us. It is the truth of the universe and must answer to a fundamental truth aspect of the Absolute. But when we step back from the outer dynamic appearances of things, not into a witness silence, but into an inner dynamic participating experience of the spirit, we find that this consciousness force, Maya, Shakti, is itself the power of the being, the self-existent, the Ishvara. So above, he typified what nature would look like if we were absorbed in the self, and here, what things would look like if we were absorbed in consciousness force. So, as we shift our mode of existence, we see reality in a different way. The being is Lord of her and of all things. We see him doing everything in his own sovereignty as the creator and ruler of his own manifestation. Or if he stands back and allows freedom of action to the forces of nature and her creatures, his sovereignty is still innate in the permission. At every step, his tacit sanction, let it be so, tathastu, is there implicit. For otherwise, nothing could be done or happen. Being and its consciousness force, spirit and nature, cannot be fundamentally dual. What nature does is really done by the spirit. There is no gulf. There is no divide. One is the other. She is he. He is she. This, too, is a truth that becomes evident when we go behind the veil and feel the presence of a living reality, which is everything and determines everything, is the all-powerful and the all-ruler. This, too, is a fundamental truth aspect of the Absolute. And now he proceeds. Again, If we remain absorbed in the silence, the creative consciousness and her works disappear into the silence. Brahman Maya. Nature and the creation for us cease to exist or be real. On the other hand, if we look exclusively at the being in its aspect of the sole existent person and ruler, the power or Shakti by which he does all things disappears into his uniqueness or becomes an attribute of his cosmic personality. The absolute monarchy of the one being becomes our perception of the universe. So this again, Ishvara and Shakti. Shakti, in a sense, disappears into Ishvara, but this is the polarity we're speaking about. And then Ishvara seems to be the all-ruler, the omnipotent, the absolute monarch, the king. Both these experiences create many difficulties for the mind due to its non-perception of the reality of the self-power, Atma-Shakti. Whether in quiescence or in action, or to a too exclusively negative experience of the self, because absorbed in the self, one ignores the manifestation, or to the too anthropomorphic character our conceptions attached to the Supreme Being as ruler, the imposition of human politics upon the divine reality. It is evident that we are looking at an infinite of which the self-power, the Atma-Shakti, is capable of many movements, all of them valid. If we look again more largely and take account of both the impersonal and the personal truth of things as one truth, if in that light, the light of personality and impersonality, we see the Bayun aspect of self and self-power, then in the person aspect, a dual person emerges, Ishvara Shakti, the divine self and creator and the divine mother and creatrix of the universe. There becomes apparent to us the mystery of the masculine and feminine cosmic principles whose play and interaction are necessary for all creation. So this view, this larger view, integrates both the impersonal and the personal into a bi-unity, two in one. And in that we can see more luminously what is the nature of the divine self and who she is that expresses that powerfully. He continues, in the superconscient truth of the self-existence, these two are fused and implied in each other, one and indistinguishable. But in the spiritual pragmatic truth of the dynamism of the universe, they emerge and become active. The divine mother energy as the universal creatrix, Maya Para Prakriti Chit Shakti, manifests the cosmic self and Ishvara and her own self-power as a dual principle. It is through her that the being, the self, the Ishvara, acts, and he does nothing except by her. Though his will is implicit in her, it is she who works out all as the supreme consciousness force who holds all souls and beings within her and as executive nature. All exists and acts according to nature. All is the consciousness force manifesting and playing with the being in millions of forms and movements into which she casts his existence. So the fusion of the two lies as the truth above. He describes it here as the superconscient. Perhaps he means to imply this is the supramental truth. But he describes in the spiritual pragmatic truth, and we might presume that this is the overmental expression of that supramental truth that allows that seeming dualism to come into play, where Ishvara expresses himself through this aspect of the Divine Mother, the Chit Shakti, Para Prakriti, or Maya. And thus all this nature comes in to play, the millions of forms in it, all of it, in a sense, with the Ishvara hidden behind or above. All is the play of the Ishvari, you might say. If we draw back from her workings, then all can fall into quiescence and we can enter into the silence. But it is in her quiescence and silence that we are quiescent and cease. And this is a truth of spiritual experience that if you seek to escape from the universe, if you want to withdraw into that quietude of the spirit, if you want to rest in the soul silence of the self, still you need the Divine Mother's permission to do that. So you have to seek ultimately her grace, and she allows you to step in. It is her quiescence that you hasten into in the leaving of the universe. If we would affirm our independence of nature, he writes, she reveals to us the supreme and omnipresent power of the Ishvara and ourselves as beings of his being. But that power is herself, and we are that in her supernature. So we see that our perspectives of this divine being or person vary depending on which aspect rotates to the front. Sri Aurobindo continues, if we would realize a higher formation or status of being, then it is still through her, through the divine Shakti, the consciousness force of the spirit, that it has to be done. Our surrender must be to the divine being through the divine mother, for it is towards or into the supreme nature. Pardon me. For it is towards or into the supreme nature that our ascension has to take place, and it can only be done by the supramental Shakti taking up our mentality and transforming it into her supramentality. Hence, transformation is per the fiat of the Mahashakti. Thus we see that there is no contradiction or incompatibility between these three aspects of existence, or between them and their eternal status and the three modes of its dynamis working in the universe. One being, one reality as self, bases, supports, informs. As Purusha, or conscious being, experiences. As Ishvara, wills, governs, and possesses its world of manifestation, created and kept in motion and action by its own consciousness force or self-power, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. A certain difficulty arises for our mind in reconciling these different faces or fronts of the one self and spirit, because we are obliged to use abstract conceptions and defining words and ideas for something that is not abstract, something that is spiritually living and intensely real. Our abstractions get fixed into differentiating concepts with sharp lines between them. But the reality is not of that nature. Its aspects are many, but shade off into each other. Its truth could only be rendered by ideas and images metaphysical and yet living and concrete, images which might be taken by the pure reason as figures and symbols, but are more than that and mean more to the intuitive vision and feeling, for they are realities of a dynamic spiritual experience. The impersonal truth of things can be rendered into the abstract formulas of the pure reason, but there is another side of truth which belongs to the spiritual or mystic vision and without that inner vision of realities, the abstract formulation of them is insufficiently alive, incomplete. The mystery of things is the true truth of things. The intellectual presentation is only truth in representation, in abstract symbols, as if in a cubist art of thought speech, in geometric figure. You can see by the thrust of his argument that Sri Aurobindo is more poet than philosopher. The power of the beautiful symbol conveys more than the abstraction of logical thought. He continues, it is necessary in a philosophic inquiry to confine oneself mostly to this intellectual presentation. And that's what we're doing here. But it is as well to remember that this is only the abstraction of the truth, and to seize it completely or express it completely, there is needed a concrete experience and a more living and full-bodied language. The concrete experience arises from the adventure of consciousness, which yoga should be for us. It should be a vehicle that carries us into the deep experience of these realities. And the full-bodied language, you know, he prefigures that in the Arya, in a series of writings which published later as the Future Poetry, but I think more tellingly is explored in his epic poem Savitri. So we must have the experience, and we must find the means by which to express it. Express it in a way that is alive and uplifting to the nature. If philosophy can do the trick, well done, philosophy. If we require art and music to achieve it for us, then open the avenue to beauty and let us go. Here, it becomes opportune to see how, in this aspect of the reality, we must regard the relation we have discovered between the one and the many. This amounts to a determination of the true connection between the individual and the divine being, between the soul and the Ishvara. In the normal theistic conception, the many are created by God. Made by him as a potter might make a vessel, they are dependent on him as are creatures on their creator. But in this larger view of the Ishvara, the many are themselves the divine one in their inmost reality, individual selves of the supreme and universal self-existence, eternal as he is eternal, but eternal in his being. Our material existence is indeed a creation of nature, but the soul is an immortal portion of the divinity, and behind it is the divine self in the natural creature. So here again we come to the nature of the individual, which Sri Aurobindo, as a realist, says is real. That what you are in your essence is eternally true, valid, cannot be extinguished. So this truth of the individuality, of course, will stand in contradiction to Advaita Vedanta and to the practice and theory of Buddhism. But Sri Aurobindo is firm in his experience of this, and hence in the philosophy that expresses his experience. He continues, still, the one is the fundamental truth of existence. The many exist by the one, and there is, therefore, an entire dependence of the manifested being on the Ishvara. As he has just said, we are real in the eternity of the divine. In that person, we find our personhood. It is not the other way around. We do not exist independent of that. We are expressions of that. this dependence is concealed by the separative ignorance of the ego, which strives to exist in its own right, although at every step it is evidently dependent on the cosmic power that created it, moved by it, a part of its cosmic being and action. This effort of the ego is clearly a misprision, an erroneous reflection of the truth of the self-existence that is within us. Theistic Vedanta agrees with this account of things, that what is true in us is part of that greater being. We are an amsha, a portion of that greater reality and personhood. But the ego is not that being. The ego is indeed a temporary house in which this spiritual individual lives. So, this ego, which carves out its separate existence, is a misprision. A misprision means, from the Latin, to take less. It means a mistake. It's an error. In other words, it reaches out and grabs for the reality, but comes back with less than is there. An erroneous reflection, he says, of the truth of the self-existence that is within us. And so, whenever we experience our ego, we experience a limitation of what we really are. We say, oh, woe is me. Look how poor and pathetic I am. Because this is only a partial reflection of what is our greater value. A person who is locked in ego can either suffer from self-glorification or self-damnation. He will never have a true and proper assessment of the nature of what dwells within. For that to occur, there has to be a conversion, an inversion of consciousness, a recognition of what is the real self, and a displacement of ego. In that, all spiritual paths agree. The ego is the block to a greater knowledge, to liberation. On that we are agreed. What is beyond that depends on how large and vast the experience is. It is that comes to you, and how integrative is your quest. It is true, Sri Aurobindo writes, that there is something in us, not in the ego, but in the self and inmost being, that surpasses cosmic nature and belongs to the transcendence. But this, too, finds itself independent of nature, only by dependence on a higher reality. It is through self-giving or surrender of soul and nature to the divine being that we can attain to our highest self and supreme reality. For it is the divine being who is that highest self and that supreme reality. And we are self-existent and eternal only in his eternity and by his self-existence. So, discarding the egoistic form, we discover the truth behind. And this is where we unite with all paths. This dependence is not contradictory of the identity, but is itself the door to the realization of the identity, so that here again we meet that phenomenon of duality expressing unity, proceeding from unity, and opening back into unity, which is the constant, secret, and fundamental operation of the universe. So this transformation that we seek, where we become truly what we are in essence and can express that in the dynamics of our being, requires from us a self-offering, an oblation which consists of our own being, a surrender which brings us into a felt unity. Whether that oneness inexperience occurs in the mind or in the heart or even in the dynamics of our being, it is still the oneness that is the fruit of it, and oneness which is the key to the greatest liberation. It is this truth of the consciousness of the infinite that creates the possibility of all relations between the many and the one, among which the realization of oneness by the mind, the presence of oneness in the heart, the existence of oneness in all the members is a highest peak, and yet it does not annul but confirms all the other personal relations and gives them their fullness, their complete delight, their entire significance. This too is the magic, but also the logic of the infinite. Next week, time. And next week, we conclude this rather long chapter, Brahman Purusha Ishvara. It's become our custom to read Savitri at the conclusion of each evening. So tonight I thought I would begin a passage and conclude it next week, which is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. This is Canto 15. The Kingdoms of the Greater Knowledge. After a measureless moment of the soul, again returning to these surface fields, out of the timeless depths where he had sunk, he heard once more the slow tread of the hours. All once perceived and lived was far away. Himself was to himself his only scene. Above the witness and his universe, he stood in a realm of boundless silences, awaiting the voice that spoke and built the worlds. A light was round him, wide and absolute. A diamond purity of eternal sight. A consciousness lay still, devoid of forms, free, wordless, uncoerced by sign or rule, forever content with only being and bliss. A sheer existence lived in its own peace, on the single spirit's bare and infinite ground. Out of the sphere of mind he had arisen. He had left the reign of nature's hues and shades. He dwelt in his self's colorless purity. It was a plane of undetermined spirit that could be a zero or round sum of things, a state in which all ceased and all began. All it became that figures the absolute, a high vast peak whence spirit could see the worlds, calm's wide epiphany, wisdom's mute home, a lonely station of omniscience, a diving board of the eternal's power, a white floor in the house of all delight. Here came the thought that passes beyond thought, hear the still voice which our listening cannot hear, the knowledge by which the knower is the known, the love in which beloved and lover are one. All stood in an original plenitude, hushed and fulfilled before they could create the glorious dream of their universal act. Here was engendered the spiritual birth. Here closed the finite's crawl to the infinite. A thousand roads leaped into eternity, or singing, ran to meet God's veilless face. The known released him from its limiting chain. He knocked at the doors of the unknowable. Thence, gazing with an immeasurable outlook, one with self's inlook into its own pure vasts, he saw the splendor of the spirit's realms, the greatness and wonder of its boundless works, the power and passion leaping from its calm, the rapture of its movement and its rest, and its fire-sweet miracle of transcendent life, the million-pointing, undivided grasp of its vision of one same stupendous all, its inexhaustible acts in a timeless time, a space that is its own infinity. A glorious multiple of one radiant self, answering to joy with joy, to love with love, all there were moving mansions of God bliss. Eternal and unique, they lived the one. There forces are great outbursts of God's truth, and objects are its pure spiritual shapes. Spirit no more is hid from its own view. All sentience is a sea of happiness, and all creation is an act of light. Out of the neutral silence of his soul, he passed to its fields of puissance and of calm, and saw the powers that stand above the world, traverse the realms of the supreme idea, and sought the summit of created things and the almighty source of cosmic change. There knowledge called him to her mystic peaks, where thought is held in a vast internal sense, and feeling swims across a sea of peace, and vision climbs beyond the reach of time. An equal of the first Creator's seers, accompanied by an all-revealing light, he moved through regions of transcendent truth, inward, immense, innumerably one. There, distance was his own huge spirit's extent. Delivered from the fictions of the mind, time's triple dividing step baffled no more. Its inevitable and continuous stream, the long flow of its manifesting course, was held in spirit's single wide regard. A universal beauty showed its face, the invisible deep-fraught significances, here sheltered behind form's insensible screen, uncovered to him their deathless harmony, and the key to the wonder book of common things. In their uniting law stood up revealed the multiple measures of the upbuilding force, the lines of the world geometer's technique, the enchantments that uphold the cosmic web, and the magic underlying simple shapes. The rest of the passage then, next Sunday, Monday to some. Jaima, namaste.